Good morning, everyone. This is Rick Davis.
And Leah Larrington.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about things everyone's passionate about, but that matter a whole lot more than sports or politics.
And, of course, people are very passionate about religion, and India is probably one of the most religious countries in the world. And yet, its approach to spirituality, as you, our audience, may have experienced, is so vastly different from what we find in Western culture with our historic roots in Christianity and Judaism. Many of you may have come across the castes of India. Why untouchables? Why the literal holy cows? Why the temples to so many deities? Why the idea that you go around many times in life, the idea of reincarnation? Why the wheel of karma that can crush you under the weight of your bad deeds or lift you up and deliver you from the limitations of earthly existence altogether? So maybe it would be a fascinating idea to sit down with Jesus and Krishna and listen as each offered his answers to the biggest questions of life. Well, today's guest gives us an opportunity to do just that. Ravi Zacharias has spoken all over the world in numerous universities, including Harvard, Princeton, and Oxford. He's addressed writers of the Peace Accord in South Africa, President Fujimori's cabinet and parliament in Peru, and military officers at the Lenin Military Academy and Center for Geopolitical Strategy in Moscow. His weekly radio program, Let My People Think, is broadcast over 1,500 stations worldwide, and his weekday program, Just Thinking, began airing in November of 2004. Ravi's the author of numerous award-winning books, including The Grand Weaver, Cries of the Heart, and today's book that we're discussing, New Birth or Rebirth, Jesus Talks with Krishna.
And Ravi, welcome to our show.
Delighted to be with both of you. Thank you.
Ravi, growing up as a Christian in Hindu India must have given you a rather unique perspective on both the beauty, the attraction to what Hindus believe, and how what your neighbors believe differed with what you believe, perhaps in ways that puzzled or even grieved you. So what have you observed about Hinduism firsthand?
Well, that's a great question, a great lead-off one. I was born in a nominal Christian home. Although my ancestors were all Hindus, they came from the highest caste in the southern part of India, the Nambudris. If one reads Hinduism, or any Hindu listening in will immediately know the Nambudris indeed are the priestly caste from the state of Kerala in India. Mm-hmm. But somewhere a few generations ago, there was a conversion in our family. And so I was born nominally Christian, but really had no faith of any kind. I was more just a practical religionist, whatever suited at the moment. It was like a buffet line. But growing up in India, you learn a lot about religion. First of all, you learn that how it gets interwoven into culture, and sometimes hard to differentiate between what is a customary thing picked up just secondhand and what is a doctrinal thing from which the practice emerges. You don't ask those questions. They're just sort of part and parcel of your upbringing. Mm-hmm. I attended all the major Hindu festivals with my friends. Actually, I didn't have a single Christian friend. All of my friends were either Hindus or Muslims or Buddhists or Sikhs, and I attended many of their functions, and one of the main reasons was you got a lot of food to eat. So I'd go into those settings. There was a pragmatic reason, but you got to learn the history, because most of the epics of Hinduism, the Mahabharata, the Ramayana, all of that, and even the story of the Bhagavad Gita, you begin to learn it in dramatic form and in ceremonial form. I observed it as sort of to live and let live kind of thing. Nobody ever discussed the why of the belief. It is just in the bloodstream of the culture.
Well, Ravi, you've distinguished yourself on university campuses around the world as a scholar who can defend Christian beliefs and offer a very thoughtful response to all comers, atheists, agnostics, Hindus, Buddhists, Muslim, and Jews, perhaps somewhat from your upbringing and your exposure to such a diverse array of spiritual beliefs. And you've written many books where you've laid out what you believe and why you believe it with great force. But it's interesting, now you've written this series of books that are these highly imaginative conversations between Jesus and people who hold very different worldviews. Jesus and Buddha in The Lotus and the Cross, Jesus and Oscar Wilde in Sense and Sensuality, Jesus and Hitler in The Lamb and the Fuhrer, and now in this book, Jesus and Krishna, New Birth or Rebirth. What do you think these books formatted as these imaginary conversations might offer our audience that a traditional book about Hinduism or Buddhism might not?
That's well said, well positioned. When I was first asked to write this, actually, I was a little uncertain whether it was my kind of writing. I'd actually suggested somebody like Peter Kraft from Boston, who did Socrates
Between
Meets Jesus
worlds.
And Between Heaven and Hell. You've probably read his writings. Brilliant writer. But the publisher came back to me and said, we really want somebody with an Eastern bent and somebody who will understand the Eastern worldviews, because we want to do a series of 10 and have a dialogue with major personages in history or at the forefront of some religious worldview. Mm. And that was the first proposal. Then the idea that in postmodern culture, stories are more engaging than just propositional truths and discussion, which, of course, was a right analysis. The difficulty was, of course, how does one put words into the mouth of the proponents? How does one put into the mouth words into the mouth of Buddha or of Krishna, of Hitler? So it involved an awful lot of research, what they actually said on these subjects, and in obviously a different setting. With Krishna, it was particularly difficult because whether Krishna actually existed as represented in the Gita is also a point of debate. Mahatma Gandhi believes that the Krishna of the Gita is a composite of various other Krishnas. For example, the Krishna in one of the sacred texts called the Bhagavatam from the south has a much more in a playful, playboy-type mood and more entertaining with the gopis, as they call them, the milkmaids and so on. It is not the kind of personage I really would have wanted to represent here. But in the Gita, he comes in veiled as a chariot driver, and he's driving Arjuna, the young man, who is going to have to go to battle to kill his own brothers and fight his brothers, and he's in consternation over this. And Krishna comes and basically tells him, look, life is a play, life is a leela, it's a drama, that's what it is. At the end, when the curtain comes down, we're all okay behind the scenes. But the reason I selected Krishna as the personage to be represented in Hinduism is because he is certainly one of the most popular of the Hindu deities. And secondly, I believe comes closest to the gospel of Christ, and yet not close enough. Mm. So I thought if I could take his words from the Bhagavad Gita and the words of Jesus in different settings, introduced two other personalities who could represent the questions of our time, one of whom was an actual figure whose story is true, and bring in the idea of reincarnation, of karma, of the so-called avatar. Does God indeed come in different forms at different times in history? What about the problem of evil? Why did the idea of the cow develop into a sacred feeling and so on? Provided for an incredible amount of research. I went to Mathura, the reputed birthplace of Krishna, and these books have become a very imagination-stirring, but I've had to stay as close to fact as possible.
Mm-hmm. Well, Ravi, we on this show focus a lot on the rational aspects of faith. In fact, we talk about the show as being a place where we try to provide evidence to help our listeners decide for themselves what they think is true and what's not about the most important questions of life. And in reading this book, I call myself a hardcore rationalist, although I am a man of faith. A long part of the road to my faith is a rational path. And then I do find at the end of my rationality, there is a step of faith that I need to take into what lies beyond time and space. But in reading this book, I became even more aware that I am, at least as I read it, of this lack of internal consistency and logic. And in my view, the absence of like credible reasons to believe that the Hindu claims are objectively true. And I suspect that that was one of the things, or maybe the main thing, you wanted to bring to light in writing this book. Did I read that right?
It is a very difficult system of thought to unpack. And almost any Hindu you talk to will at one point use the phrase way of life. It's really our way of life. It's our culture. Hinduism is not monolithic. You will very seldom find a systematic theology on Hinduism. Mm-hmm. Because if you go back to the Vedic writings, which predate the Gita that I have taken, In the Vedas, you can get almost any belief system you want. You can get pantheism, meaning you're part of the divine. You can get atheism, that there is no ultimate personal deity. You can get polytheism, 330 million gods in the pantheon of Hinduism. And the great Indian philosopher, Dr. Radhakrishnan, who taught at Oxford, and one of whose great proteges became my professor of Hinduism at Cambridge, where I went for a brief study in philosophy. Dr. Radhakrishnan went on to become India's president, considered in recent times the most knowledgeable exponent of Hinduism. He makes the comment in his book, The Hindu View of Life. He said, yes, you can even be an atheist and still be a Hindu. Mm-hmm. So when you get these systemic disparities and contradictions, Rick, you're absolutely right. You do not come in with a harmonious representation that this is the worldview. That's why what I did, rather than go into all of these subjects that could be very hard to disentangle, I took two beliefs that every Hindu has with another Hindu in common, the idea of reincarnation, the idea of karma. No matter what background one has in Hinduism, those two I found as non-negotiable. But in terms of a system of thought, yes. But having said that, if you start even thinking of reincarnation, is it a coherent way to really think of life as every birth being a rebirth? And we can get into that as well. But yes, the four questions of life are these: origin, meaning, morality, and destiny. That's what forms a worldview. And you have to find answers that are correspondingly true, and when it's put together, a system that is coherent. Hinduism does not stand the test of truth when those four questions are appealed to. And one thing I've done with these books is presented it to Hindu scholars before I give the final text and believers in it. And it's very interesting. They would either smile or they would write back and say, well, yes, you have represented Krishna correctly here, but not everything that Krishna taught is my belief as well.
Yeah.
And you begin to say, is there anybody who can tell me what is actually
Orthodox
representative of every belief?
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's dive into the book a little bit, Ravi. In this book, New Birth or Rebirth, and we're talking to Ravi Zacharias here, the author, this imaginary conversation between Jesus and Krishna, yet drawn very closely from their writings so that Ravi's not trying to put words in their mouths. It begins in Mathura, India, which is celebrated as the birthplace of Krishna. And by way of introduction, both Jesus and Krishna answer the question, who are you? Where were you born? So just for, just a tight contrastive response here, how did Jesus respond to this question?
Well, you see, for Jesus, the interesting contrast is this, that while reincarnation is a cyclical idea, it is unsustainable cyclically, because this present incarnation, if you go backwards, you have to have a finite number of incarnations. And so the Hindu runs into the problem logically with his own reincarnational self. But in the answer of Christ, Christ presents himself exactly as the way Isaiah spoke, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. Those words are remarkably specific. The child is born, the son is not born, the son is given, because the son eternally existed. So Jesus' answer to that question is that only that which is a finite being comes into being when it wasn't in existence prior. But for Christ, the eternal Son of God, there is no moment when he is not. And so he speaks from the depths of eternity and not from the point of non-being into being. Jesus is presented as the eternal Son of God, and he said, I have not been caused, I have not been brought into being, I have always existed. In contradistinction, the historicity of Krishna is in doubt, and even if it weren't in doubt, the concept of an avatar, where he comes in different forms at different times, actually then muddies the waters. Did he come as Muhammad? Did he come as Buddha? If he came as Buddha, how could he be the same when Buddha actually was born a Hindu but renounced Hinduism, renounced the Vedas, and renounced the caste system, and came out with his Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path and so on? So in contradistinction, Christ eternally existed. Krishna is presented as an avatar or one who comes in various forms. But if that is indeed believed to be true, then the teachings are diametrically contradictory each time.
Yes, he said in the book, as you put his part of the conversation, I am an idea, Jesus. It doesn't really matter whether I was born or not. It's my teaching that's important. And there are so many other distinctions, and we want to get into them, but it's just about time for a break.
And we are interviewing Ravi Zacharias, who is the author of many books. The one we're talking about today is entitled New Birth or Rebirth, Jesus Talks with Krishna. And we will continue this interview after the break. And this is Rick Davis.
And Leah Leary.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most. And we'll be back in a minute. Main Street Crossing, a live entertainment venue in Tomball, is home to a very unusual assortment of groups and activities. One of these is a Christian gathering we call Sundays, S-O-N-D-A-Y-S. At Sundays, we try to live out Christian life together 7 days a week using Main Street Crossing as home base. Any and every time of the week, Sunday's friends can be found sipping coffee, eating lunch, or sipping a beer or wine at Main Street Crossing, never knowing which friend will come in the door to join in. And yes, there is a short church service for Sundays on Sunday evenings at 7 o'clock. But to us, the Sunday service is a very small part of our 7-day-a-week friendship. Whether you're personally at the end of your rope or feeling like you'd like to help those who are, you're welcome at Sundays at Main Street Crossing. Stop by Main Street Crossing and see what's up with Sundays. Private parties, wedding receptions, business meetings. Main Street Crossing in Tomball is an awesome place to hold these events. Most advertisements are full of exaggeration, but this one is not. If there was a word that communicated better than the word unique, we'd use it. But we can't think of a better word. So if you go to MainStreetCrossing.com, you'll see for yourself that your friends and family will be wowed if you book your events there. Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about the most important questions of life.
And we're interviewing Ravi Zacharias, author of a number of books. The one we're discussing today is New Birth or Rebirth, Jesus Talks with Krishna. And Ravi comes at this from a very unique perspective, as he was born in India, grew up there as a Christian, had his own spiritual journey, and now writes books that compares the Christian worldview with a number of the Eastern worldviews. He's written a couple of books that are quite interesting. They're Conversations with Buddha and Krishna, The Lotus and the Cross, A Conversation with Buddha, Jesus Talks with Buddha, and New Birth or Rebirth, Jesus Talks with Krishna.
Okay. Now, Ravi, what is the Hindu story about origins, the beginning of the universe and our planet? For our listeners, what's their equivalent of our Genesis story, and how does it line up with modern-day scientific views?
There is actually no real cosmogony when you think of the Hindu view of life. Unlike, say, the Islamic view, which will talk to you about being conceived from a clot of blood and so on, the concept of Hinduism in terms of origins is much more one of the war in the heavens type. All of the stories and all of the mythologies have to do with either the gods at war, something more akin to the Greek mythological stories, and many of the Vedic writings, which go back 12 to 1500 BC, are really the speculations of the sages in terms of what is the ultimate meaning of life. They don't give you specifically a theory of origins. Now, if you were to ask a Hindu, he would be very comfortable with the evolutionary aspect of life, but will ultimately posit the divine nature of every entity rather than the material nature of every entity. They're much more pantheistic. However, they are naturalistic in the sense that there is no I-you in a relationship between God and man. There is just one ultimate impersonal absolute. That is the most theoretical side of Hinduism. If you get into the Gita and you start talking about origins there, my, oh my, oh my, the stories you will get in terms of how one fetus was multiplied into 100 and all this, it really becomes more mythological and speculative rather than prescriptive.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're talking with Ravi Zacharias, author of New Birth or Rebirth, Jesus Talks with Krishna. And in this imaginary conversation, Ravi, you had Krishna say that all of life is a leela, a play, a drama. The universe is simply a cosmic puppet theater for the gods. And we just talked about, you know, how the characters come on the stage, so to speak. Jesus asked Krishna, how do they exit? Where do they go after they exit the stage? How does Krishna answer?
The interesting thing about trying to come to terms with the leela is really the story of how one explains evil. That is the context. That is the context in which he really answers the question of why it is a leela and not a reality. He does that because he has to voice the fact that he is telling young Arjuna to go to a battlefield and to go into a decision, which Arjuna is really not wanting to make. He doesn't want to kill his own relatives. But Krishna basically is telling him this is a drama, evil is not real, evil is all on the backstage and so on. But when Krishna actually starts answering the question of how one deals with ultimate reality, he portrays the fact that the reality that seems to us as real is actually Maya, and ultimately backstage we're all friends, and he considers himself just contrary to what Jesus is talking about in the reality of evil. He says souls have existed for millions of years. They come in different costumes, like any man changes his clothes, and each life is actually a death, and at the end of many, many reincarnations, you ultimately become consummate with the one ultimate personality that you were designed to be. So he does not deal with life as an end and a moment after which you come to terms with yourself, but that life is a repetitive cycle. You come in a different costume, and at the end of it, you go back to the ultimate reality when the curtain has been drawn.
Mm-hmm. Ravi, I thought an interesting point brought out in the dialogue between Jesus and Krishna was where the subject has to do with what seems to me to be a inconsistent view of animals and where they rank in the whole scheme of things relative to humans. Would you elaborate on this point just a little bit?
This is a very touchy subject for the Hindu. You know, I remember when I first moved to the West, and even though I wasn't a Hindu, became a little alarmed at the way the concept of cow worship was being portrayed and so on. But you know, Rick, it is fascinating when you grow up with things around you, you don't really notice them. There's a Chinese proverb that says, if you want to know what water is, don't ask the fish, because the fish never thinks
really
from a counter perspective.
Yeah.
But I remember in researching this book and going to Mathura, I couldn't believe the things I was seeing. I think an average Hindu would be quite hard-pressed to escape what is going on there. You walk the streets and you see one beggar after another asking for alms, and of course the tourists are there galore. And then you walk into the temple and you'll see the cow meandering in and out there. And if the cow walks past you, the devout person will touch the hump of the cow, touch his forehead as an act of worship. There are what they call the gosalas, gosh, literally the word for the cow there. They will keep it in certain conclaves and be revered and treated well. You go to Delhi and watch the bullock carts there and watch the guy with a stick in his hand hammering that bullock for not moving fast enough, and in its bony back taking all the whippings and beatings. When you read Swami Prabhupada, the founder of the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, he goes into an extensive dialogue on why the cow is so sacred. It is representative of life. in the milk and the butter and what India Indians will call ghee, which is purified butter, and we use it very much in weddings and cooking and so on. And he says, actually, the air as it falls upon the back of the cow becomes purified and all of that. Very strongly anti-meat-eating stance, and says, if you want to eat meat, okay, in your next reincarnation, you will be sent as an animal, like a lion with its claws and all of that, so that you can eat all the meat you want. And you pause a moment and say, wait a minute. Just a few pages ago, you were telling me that you cannot do violence to the animal world because it is as sacred as the human world. Now you're telling me if I'm naughty and eat meat, I'm going to come back as a wretched lion with claws in my paws and so on. So the idea of the reverence for all of life is prevalent in theory, but it is not in practice. It is not uncommon to see the animal world very ill-treated as sort of your dog-eat-dog world. Their reverence? Theory? Yes. Practice? No. Now, after Krishna and after the Hinduism and after Buddha came somebody one better, Mahavira. He had the Jains as followers. The Jains will actually have masks on their mouth so that they don't even inhale a mosquito by mistake, because even that is representative of life.
That's so being consistent with your worldview.
Yep, exactly. He was pushing the envelope to its ultimate limit. On the theoretical side of it, as a Christian, we would want to respect the animal world. The Bible tells us not to muzzle the ox. And when Jesus uses the metaphor, he talks about the lion lying down with the lamb. And I think we are responsible to be respectful of all of life, but we also see a difference in kind, not just in degree.
Mm. Ravi, I know it's a little dangerous for any of us to only expose ourselves and read the materials that support our own view. And I have really tried to expose myself to non-Christian viewpoints. And one thing I've been particularly interested in is I'm interested in the evidences that speak to my Christian viewpoint, I'm equally interested in the evidences that are out there for these other faith systems. And so I can compare and understand why people believe things differently than I believe. And I have found, and I'm interested, this goes beyond your book, Ravi, in some of the research I've done on you on the internet, and I know that you're very knowledgeable about sort of an apologetic view to these various other faith systems. And as I've dug around out there looking for evidence, archaeological, scientific, fulfilled prophecy, etc., of the, you know, these other faith systems, Islam, Hindu, Mormon, Scientology, etc., I have found really very little evidence, rational evidence of the types I mentioned that support these views. I could envision somebody putting together an anthology where they found the best mind, the best Hindu mind, the best Muslim mind, the best Scientological mind, if that's a term, and tried to see if we could aggregate in one volume the evidences for these various viewpoints, including Christian, a Christian apologist, putting those kinds of evidence together in a book, so that we could really see what there is, and all of us who are interested in this area could compare. What do you think a book like that would show?
Well, I think it would be a fascinating reading to compare and contrast, but your point is well taken. The Christian faith, as far as I know, possible exception with Islam, but Islam does not allow you to critique the Quran, and so they really cannot be taken seriously academically unless they allow the critique of the Quran, which they are totally resistant towards, and it is a dictation theory of inspiration, very different to the Christians' or theory of inspiration. But if you put them all together, it would be very quick to notice that the most serious attitude towards history, logic, experience, metaphysics, and just the sheer reality of the human condition, the Christian worldview is by far the most systematic and coherent of them all. contrary to what Muslims will sometimes say, you know, there are so many denominations and sects and so on. I remember one of them at the University of Michigan telling me that, and I said, whoa. I said, stop right there. I said, you've got the Sunnis and the Shias and the Ahmadiyyas and the Sufis and the Druze and all of these marvelous varieties that you read about in such names and so on. I said, and when you start looking at the difference between the Shias and the Sunnis and the Sufis and the Ahmadiyyas, some of you will call some of them apostate and so on. But when you look at the Christian worldview, the denominations that are formed either adhere to the interpretation, the authority of the scriptures, or they have gone the way of some other human authority. If you take the teaching of the scriptures and you put it side by side on origin, meaning, morality, destiny, God, humanity, and our condition, you will find the most coherent worldview to be propounded within the Christian worldview. And yet that's the one the left-wing media seem and the academics want to attack the most, when the rest really don't even stand the test of reason.
We're interviewing Ravi Zacharias, the author of New Birth or Rebirth, Jesus Talks with Krishna, and it is time for a break, so we'll do that, and when we come back, we will continue. And this is Rick Davis.
And Lael Arrington.
And you're listening to The Things That Matter Most, and we'll be back in a minute.
Did you know that 1 out of 15 Americans goes to prison during their lifetime? Many inmates come to prison as proven entrepreneurs, having run successful enterprises such as drug rings and gangs. They're passionate, intelligent, and willing to take risks. Even the most unsophisticated drug dealers understand business concepts like competition, profitability, and risk management. What if these influential business leaders in the criminal world were equipped to run legitimate companies? The Prison Entrepreneurship Program, or PEP, provides inmates nearing release with values-based entrepreneurial training, enabling them to productively reenter society. To make sure that we're not taking old dope dealers and equipping them to just become better dope dealers, we have a rigorous screening process to ensure that they're committed to personal transformation. My name is Catherine Rohr, and I'm the founder and executive director of PEP. I left behind a career in venture capital and private equity in New York City to take on this mission in Texas in 2004. In just 3 years, PEP has produced unparalleled results with our 300 graduates, an employment rate of 98%, a return to prison rate of only 1.6%, and the launch of 36 entrepreneurial businesses. We not only teach these former inmates to be successful, but also to give back to their communities. We're proud to say that 30% of PEP's donors are its own graduates. We've also recruited 800 senior business executives and MBA students from 12 programs, including Harvard and Stanford, to provide hands-on assistance to graduates. This is all in only 3 years. PEP is the only program of its type nationally, and its groundbreaking work has been featured in NBC Nightly News, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, Entrepreneur Magazine, and Texas Monthly. Crime is everybody's problem, including yours. You might think that inmates get locked up and stay locked up, but the reality is that 95% of inmates are released from prison back into our communities. I'm inviting you to do something about it. You have everything that PEP needs to make a difference: your financial resources, contacts, and expertise. So how can you get involved? You can give, come to prison with us, you can become a mentor or help our release graduates. For more information, go to www.pep.org. That's pep.org.
This is Rick Davis, host of The Things That Matter Most. Thanks for listening to our show. Do you have trouble remembering to tune us in on Sunday mornings at 9? Well, the pressure's off, because we have 3 ways to help. You can go to our website, thethingsthatmattermost.org, where all our past shows are archived. While you're at our site, you can sign up for a weekly email reminder to tune into our next week's guest or hot topic. Finally, you can also sign up for an automatic download on iTunes, so without any effort, you'll always have the latest show on your iPod. So, archived shows, email reminders, and iPod subscriptions. 3 ways to get our broadcasts if you miss us on Sunday morning. Thanks for listening. Okay, we're back on The Things That Matter Most, the show where we talk about the most important questions of life.
And we're interviewing Ravi Zacharias, who it speaks with a unique perspective since he grew up in India as a Christian, who's speaking on Hinduism in a book called New Birth or Rebirth, Jesus Talks with Krishna. And we're talking about what would it be like if we got Jesus and Krishna together for an imaginary conversation, but taken very closely from their own writings. What would they say about the big questions of life?
Now, Robbie, I made the comment to Lael recently that it seems to me like the greatest question of spiritual debate isn't really about the existence of God, although that seems to be the one that gets all the press with Richard Dawkins and Sam Harris and all that crowd. But perhaps that's not really the greatest question of debate. Even Michael Shermer concedes that better than 90% of Americans believes there's a God. But the greatest question it seems to me to address is really who God is, not whether or not he exists. And of course, that's what you've addressed here in your book. Do you think that the question of God's identity is really the pivotal question?
It is, because no matter how loudly the atheists shout, they are really out of touch with a major part of the world. I remember speaking to the president of Albania, Mr. Berisha. He's a medical doctor, and I was in his office. He's a cardiologist, and I remember him just looking out of the window after I'd finished addressing the parliament, and this was the most atheistic nation in the world. He said, you know, we've tried it our way and failed. We've tried it our way and failed. It's time to try it differently now. And he even used the person of God in his reference in our conversation. Atheism has a lot of media power, but in reality, people are deeply spiritually minded. So the question is, how can I be spiritually minded and follow the path that is true? Not just that is pragmatically satisfying. Sincerity is a wonderful attribute, but a person can be sincerely wrong as well. So yes, who is God? In fact, I have a major address by that very title, who God is. That is the question that needs to be answered.
Mm-hmm. Robbie, recently we interviewed Deepak Chopra on his new book, Why is God Laughing? The Path to Spiritual Optimism and Joy. And to give you a little background, in this book, Mickey Fellows is a comedian who's not laughing because he's so self-absorbed. He's so bent on controlling his circumstances and other people. And then this spiritual guide comes into his life. This guide, Francisco, tries to explain to him about the big questions of life. And one of them, of course, is where do you find joy? Where do you find happiness? And he sort of takes him on this path of, quote, you know, this path of growth and enlightenment, and he comes to finally at this point in the process, he tells him happiness based on a reason can be snatched away from you at any moment. Now you are happy without a reason. That's far more durable. With nothing to like or dislike, you can be happy within yourself. Existence is pure gold. So in the course of the interview, I asked Deepak, so are desires bad? And he replied, no, without desire, there wouldn't be any creativity. Yet, I think his book clearly made this case for a kind of love and benevolence toward others that was very detached. So I told him I kind of struggled to empathize with the main character's joy. And if you are interested, I'll just say this to my listeners sort of parenthetically, if you're interested in that conversation, you can access either on our website or on iTunes the episode with Deepak Chopra just from a few weeks ago at thethingsthatmattermost.org or on iTunes. So anyhow, he has this character who's trying to find joy. And as he walks along this path of enlightenment, he does grow and become less self-absorbed. But he also becomes more withdrawn and more isolated. He lives with no family. His one companion is his dog. At the end of the story, he even gives his dog away without caring. And this is how Deepak responded, and perhaps you could respond to him.
There's more empathy. There's more compassion. But to our everyday, ordinary state of consciousness, it seems totally impersonal, when in fact it's the kind of love that is denied to none and focused on none. It's love that radiates from you like light from a bonfire, and it's your essential state. And it is, yes, impersonal, but it is also suprapersonal. And in only in this kind of detachment you have the real ability to give and to be compassionate without the melodrama that comes from being attached. And, you know, when we're attached, who are we attached to? We're not attached to the person. We're attached to ourselves and our needs.
And I couldn't help but notice, Ravi, that in your book, New Birth or Rebirth, you have Krishna say almost the same thing, that the goal in life is to unify the self with the Brahman, the impersonal absolute. So how would you respond, speaking from a different worldview as this?
What I hate to say it this bluntly, it's what I call linguistic trickery.
Mm-hmm.
You take words and manufacture concepts that are really vacuous, suprapersonal. This is not personal, but it's suprapersonal. When you look at the empires they build on this philosophy, better believe it, it is very personal. There is a very personal attachment to these big empires. All one needs to do is make some comment about a person like Deepak Chopra and make some statement that he objects to, and you'll see the best personal lawyer at your door dealing with you, because the empires that are built on this kind of language, it boggles my mind that there's an audience out there to take such concepts and not tease them out. My answer to him is this. Jesus said, you are to be hungering, and you hunger and thirst after righteousness. You are to be loving, and that loving is not in an isolation. But you know, Leah, this is exactly what Swami Prabhupada says in his International Society for Krishna Consciousness. When he left his family and moved to the United States and was living here by himself, with his teaching and building again a huge empire, somebody asked him how this was possible. He said he had reached the stage of detachment. But you can be sure there's a lot of money involved in this state of detachment. It is just detached from other responsibilities. When Jesus was on the cross, it is incredible to me and marvelous to me that here is the King of the universe bringing salvation to the world. And he looks at his mother and points to a young man and says, you take care of her now. He gave him a new responsibility and a new attachment so that his mother would be taken care of. You seek first the kingdom of God, and in that kingdom you see that in as much as you do the least of these, my brethren, you do it unto me. The institution of marriage, the institution of parenting, the institution of fellowship in the church, the institution of the image of God, where you see in each person God's image disclosed, gives you the responsibility to love and care. It is not a detached isolation where you are all of a sudden in the so-called suprapersonal. That is just a manufactured and a construct that is made to suit an idea which is presented by a person who relates to other persons in order to build an empire built by persons.
Well, Ravi, you've said that so eloquently. In my own attempt to respond to Deepak, I just said, well, I struggled to be empathetic with your character because he was so detached. And I tried to just say, okay, here is, I think of another story. I think of the story of Gladiator and General Maximus. And I think how here's a hero who was the opposite of detachment. He was deeply attached to his family, his friends, even his country, the glory of Rome as he understood it, and how out of that love he sacrificed himself. He laid down his own needs and agenda for their welfare and their joy. And it's this love for others and for God and his love for us, person to person, that ultimately gives us the happiness we long for. And when I think of love, for example, I love for God, I care for him deeply as a person, and God's word tells me that he cares deeply for me as a person. And Deepak responded that divine consciousness cannot be attached. It would lose its infinite creativity. And then he went on to say this remark.
Well, I think a person is an illusion. It doesn't really exist. Which person are you talking about? The person you were when you were a baby, a teenager, now, tomorrow? Everything about you is dynamically shifting. What we call a person is a transient, ephemeral, diaphanous behavior of the universe. So it's like wisps of smoke in the wind. So I, for a long time ago, realized I wasn't a person, and that as long as I thought of myself as a person, I would see people everywhere. But when I shifted to a deeper level, then I saw God everywhere. And I felt a different kind of love. I don't think God is a person. You know, we have our planet of us, ours is a speck of dust and somewhere in the junkyard of infinity in billions of galaxies. And there are now, you know, people say other universes. To reduce God into the volume of a body, the span of a lifetime, give him an ethnic background, a male gender identity, I think is to, in a way, diminish the magnificence of the universal being that has created multitudes of universes in so many dimensions of space and time. Well, you know, the way I see it, the drop, the ocean, and the wave are all different manifestations of a universal domain, that there is the universal, but by identifying with bits and pieces of it, we create the experiences of the personal.
And so, Ravi, your response?
My. You know, if I'd said something like this, my father would have wanted me to go and get some tests done. The thing is, when a person makes such comments, he's playing to the stands.
Mm-hmm.
He's playing to the spiritual, quote, mood of the day. Which person are you talking about, he is asking. Can such a question be posed in a court of law? Can such a question be posed when a contract is in dispute? His idea of a material change, of course, a little bit of atomic theory, a little bit of quantum theory, a little bit of physics, a little bit of medicine, a little bit of metaphysics, and all of that hodgepodge in a total nonsensical assertion. Ask him when he refers to his son, is he referring to a person? Has he made a will? Which person made that will? Which persons is it made to? When he promised to love his wife, is she different to what she was then? And does the promise still pertain? Or is this changed because she has changed? You see, this is the big difference, Leah,
mm-hmm.
between what Jesus affirmed. He told us to see the person as of essential worth. And so when Deepak Chopra says, you know, is he an ethnic? Is he a gender? He's playing to the stands. That's exactly what he's doing. Actually, there have been offers made for me to dialogue with him on a program, but we accepted. We have never heard back from him on that. These are monologues that sound marvelous, but they really have no ontic reference or existential relevance. When I told my wife 36 years ago that I will love her, for better or for worse, I didn't expect that just because there's a molecular change every few days that she will be a different person. It is the same essential person. In the Christian faith, God is a person and a being in relationship. And that's the difference. And that's why I point out in the Gita too, that I know in what Krishna says, two words, that the personal relationship that we have with God, the relationship and the forgiveness that he offers, to me, it is nothing more than, again, games with language which will not stand the test of scrutiny in any court of law, in any contractual dispute, or even in his own will. If the person is not of any value, ask him to leave his will to me. I would greatly appreciate it. Why is he leaving it to his son if there is no such person as his son?
Well, Ravi, I think all of us, if we're deeply honest, and I'm talking to you too out there, if you're in your car or listening to your radio at home, we all realize that our greatest happiness is ultimately bound up in being loved and loving others well. And we all know that there is something that's the barrier to our love. And a Christian would call it sin. It was really interesting when we got into a discussion with Deepak. We got into a discussion in a book where he's dealing with the concept of sin in his book. And in the book, the guide says, you want to hear God's favorite joke? Sin. That's the joke? Mickey responds. Absolutely, his guide responds. Whenever God hears that people believe in sin, it cracks him up. And then, so when I asked Deepak to help our audience understand what he meant by sin as a joke, he responded this way.
Substitute one word for sin, it's called ignorance. And therefore, you know, it's not something that we do consciously. We are ignorant of the deeper reality, and we separate ourselves as a result of that. When we when we go beyond our ignorance and find a greater expansion in our awareness, then we realize that it was a mistake of our intellect.
Okay, Ravi, just from that clip, you can tell that he's saying that sin is just ignorance, and it all boils down to this identity question of who are we? We're not a person. We're part of the divine. I would guess, coming from a Christian point of view, that you have a very different take on sin and what is needed to overcome sin.
That is very, very much the teaching of Gautama Buddha, that if you cease to desire, you will cease to suffer. And our problem is that it's ignorance. We think we know, but we don't. I was leaving a country, I'll leave unnamed, where a woman had just rescued a baby in a marketplace where they come at the end of the day to get their desires. They combine snake's blood with strong alcohol and are given whatever they want. It's called Snake Alley in this particular city and country.
Wow.
She rescued an 18-month-old baby that had been repeatedly molested and raped by a man under the influence of liquor and snake's blood, which he had asked for before he was intoxicated. She says they rescue children and women like this all the time. When a man gets away from his business suit and goes into a place like that, asking for a concoction of this that'll take his brains away, and then asks afterwards he wants to have an 18-month-old baby girl or a baby with whom he wants to have intercourse, is that ignorance or is that evil? It is a thorough, simplistic way. The joke is exactly what the evil one would want us to believe about these things. Hitler and his whole band of murderers that murdered millions and millions of people, Stalin, 15 million, Mao Zedong, to just simply say these were ignorant people. If they are ignorant, then they are not culpable. You cannot hold a person responsible for what they do not know. And I believe it is this kind of mitigation of responsibility. And that's why Krishna too himself says, what we need is a sacrifice, the prajapati. Why does he want a sacrifice? To atone what? And yet he stops short. He's not able to provide that. Christ goes to the cross. The word forgiveness and the word grace are so unique to us. I have done many things intentionally, not out of ignorance. He can call it all he wants as ignorance, but he himself knows there are some things you know are wrong and still do it. And to put it all under the category of ignorance, again, is playing with words. The gospel offers forgiveness by the grace of Christ, and the imperative for us to move forward. Deepak Chopra, I'm afraid, is metaphysically so weak here, but he's playing to the stands. I find it incomprehensible that such teaching actually masquerades a sophisticated science and philosophy.
Well, thank you very much for that response. It would be great to maybe have you on here sometime with Deepak. I don't know. Maybe we can try the same thing at some point.
Yes,
and actually get a dialogue going. Maybe that needs to be another book. Jesus Talks with Deepak.
That's what you need.
Yeah.
Jesus Talks to Deepak.
Yeah,
you know, that's a great idea. That's a great idea.
Well, thank you so much for your time, Ravi.
Yes, Ravi, thank you. Great.
Thanks to both of you. The
interview.
Lord bless you. An honor to be with you.
Okay. Right.
And
thanks.
We highly recommend his book, New Birth or Rebook, Jesus Talks with Krishna.
Honor to be with both of you. Thank you. God bless you.
All right. And thank you so much, Ravi. And we will be in touch maybe about another version of the Faith and Culture devotional. Thank you so much for your interest in
Bye-bye.
That project.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay, Leah, well, I guess that wraps it up. Great interview. And for our audience, here we are one more time, getting ready to go into another busy week with plenty of things to keep us entirely occupied. But it's the kinds of questions we ask on this show that in the end are going to be the most important. So this week, don't get so busy that you don't take time to think about the things that matter most.